So that won't be too far away from the topic of this one.
Okay, so first of all, let me give you a theorem that I learned about maybe 10 years ago and that I found very, very surprising at first sight. And I want to explain first what the theorem is and why is it surprising. And then we'll go and introduce some tools. So suppose you take a law on matrices of the form that is written there. So this is something that should be familiar. For example, if V of X is X, these are just the V-sharp matrices. The matrices X, X star, where X are IID Gaussians. Okay? So that's a fancy way of writing that. Zn is a normalization constant to make the whole thing a probability measure. And dx, just, so dx is just a product over all I and j of dx ij. So there is no, x is not Hermitian. Okay? So that's a law on matrices. It depends, the weight depends on the singular value of the matrix, on the eigenvalues of x, x star. Okay, and let's write the eigenvalues of this matrix. Let's denote them by lambda I. And so once we have lambda I, we can form the empirical measure, or the cumulative, the density of states of that. Note that the lambda I's are now in the complex plane. They are not real, okay? Because I'm looking at the eigenvalues of x, not of x, x star. Okay? And here is a theorem of two physicists, Feinberg and Z. They prove the following. Suppose that V is a polynomial, some gross conditions, whatever, but and obviously it should be the... Okay. Take V a polynomial, and then ln V converges. And it converges to a deterministic limit. That's not so surprising if you're used to random matrices, but that's only because you're used to Hermitian. So, okay, it converges to something deterministic, but what is really surprising is that the support of the limit is a single ring in the complex plane, as a disk is also a ring. So the inner radius may be zero, but it consists of just one ring. So the single ring theorem has nothing to do with rings in algebra. It's just a ring in the complex plane. Sorry if I misled anybody in the audience. Okay, so, and, yes?
It would not be symmetric.
Sorry?
The assumption is that the matrix X is complex.
It's complex, although this is probably not essential.
But for real, it would not be symmetric, I believe.
Who is not symmetric?
The distribution.
Sorry. Now, I wrote it like that, but in fact, we know not only the support, we know everything. One can characterize a radial component of the measure. Okay? And the proof is a physics-type proof.
It's very instructive. It gives lots of ideas. It's hard to rigorize. And what it does, it uses expansions and something that I will call a hermitization trick, and which is extremely important in this game, and I'll talk about that later. Now, here is an example that we should keep in mind. So the example is V equal to X, or X over 2. In this case, as I said, this is just the Gaussian law, right? Because the trace of X, X star is just going to be the sum. If I make the game as if everything is real and not complex, this will be just the sum of X, I, J square. And this quantity, if I take the exponent, this just means that I have a Gaussian law on the entry. And if X are complex, then I get a Gaussian law, Gaussian complex law on each entry. And this has a name, at least in the complex case, this is called Ginibri's ensemble. And in that particular case, we know the joint distribution of the eigenvalue. So this is a very special case in which a miracle occurs, and you can write down the joint distribution of eigenvalues. Now, I have to warn you, in the Hermitian case, if you put a V or you don't put a V, so if you're Gaussian or you have a general V, you always can write down the joint distribution of eigenvalues, because it will be this van der Monde times e to the sum of V of lambda I. In the non-normal case that we are dealing with, that's not true, because V does not depend on the eigenvalue. It depends on the singular value. Okay? So there's an accident of nature happening in the Gaussian case that allows us to decompose and to find really the joint distribution of eigenvalues. This was done by Ginibri in the 60s. You get this kind of expression. We saw yesterday expressions at least of this form. And now, when I come to such an expression, I'm happy because I can do everything. Because I can derive limits, I can derive everything, and I want to explain one particular way of looking at such expressions that allow you to do that. So you, first of all, what is the conclusion? The conclusion is that the empirical law of the eigenvalues converges to the uniform measure on the disk. And, of course, as I said, inner radius equals zero is permissible, so that's perfectly fine. Now, how do you prove such a statement? Well, one way, and the way I want to emphasize, is to say that you have a large deviation principle. So what would that mean? So first of all, what is a large deviation principle in this context? I have a series of objects, Ln. Ln are measures, in this case, measures over the complex plane. And a large deviation principle for me would be a statement like that. The probability that Ln is in some set A decays exponentially and I will write that because of some technicality that I want to gloss over. So that tells us that the rate of decay of that probability is given by some function, or by the minimum of some function, over the set A. Now, what is this mysterious function I? So that is going to be easy to understand. Look at the joint distribution of eigenvalues and write it in terms of Ln. What do we get if we do that? Well, the term e to the minus n sum of lambda I squared, that's easy. Because the sum of lambda I squared, this is equal to n times the integral of x squared dln. Right? Ln is an empirical measure. So this sum is just this integral. Okay? Yes?
Can you tell us again what v of x was? I see it's x over 2, but how it comes into the formulation?
So the expression, the joint distribution, maybe I should write it up here, that you have it in front of it, the law is e to the minus n raise v of x. That is star dx divided by z. So if V is X half, this just means random matrix IID Gaussian circular variables. Okay? So this is easy. What about the other terms, the van der Monde term, the product of lambda I minus lambda J squared? Well, that's actually not very hard either. Take the log of that. If you take the log, what you see, so E to the log, what do you see in the exponent? You see the sum of log of lambda I minus lambda j. Now that's for all I less than j. Okay, factor 2 we don't care about. And that's a quadratic form in the empirical measure. So this you can represent as a double integral of log of x minus y dln of x dln of y times n squared.
Right? If you just think what this means when ln is a sum of Dirac's, this double integral is just this sum. Okay? And I should say, except for the diagonal. So there's a small problem here because this allows for I equal j, and I don't want that. So let's just modify the definition of log such that log of 0 is 0. Then we are fine. Okay? You can see that there are technical issues coming about, but I'm going to disregard them because they can be handled. I'm only going not to disregard technical issues that cannot be handled. Okay. So now we have the joint law that I foolishly covered. So what was our law? Our law now was e to the minus the double integral of, so we have n squared coming out. Actually, we will have log of x minus y, dln of x, dln of y, minus the integral of x squared dln of x. The normalization, the fact that I had n times trace of v was exactly done so that the factor n squared weights both terms. Okay? So that's a function, that's a functional on the space of probability measures. So let's call this guy j of ln. So j is just the functional. J goes from m1 of c to r. So it's a nice functional. And now what you have is that your distribution is proportional to this guy. So what happens when n goes to infinity? Obviously, ln should go to the minimizers, actually here is the maximizers, so I prefer to write. Let's call this minus j so that I don't get confused all the time. So ln will go to the minimizer of j over the space of probability measures. So ln should go as n goes to infinity. And let me put here quotation marks because I told you nothing about topology and nothing about what do I mean by convergence. But ln should go to the minimizer of j of dot on one of c. Okay? And that minimizer, lo and behold, is a uniform distribution on the disk. But this gives you much more information. This gives you information about, for example, what is the probability to see a very atypical distribution. Okay? For example, I can ask what is the probability that I charge a neighborhood of 2, of the point 2 in the complex plane, which is outside the unit disk. What is the probability that if I take a small ball near 2, the measure there is 1/4 at least? And I can answer this question by this large deviation principle. Now the fine print, what do I mean by converge? So by converge, I mean an upper bound, a lower bound. The upper bound, you have to take the closure of A when you do the minimization. The lower bound, you have to take the interior of A. Since I said that, I have to take what is the topology so that we can talk about closure and interior. The topology is weak convergence. Okay? So now I told you an honest theorem. I didn't give you all the details of the proof, but the honest theorem is that there is a large deviation principle. Namely, you have an upper bound. The limsup of that is bounded by this infimum when here you take the closure. The lower bound is the infimum where here you take the interior. And everything is understood in the sense of weak topologies. Okay.
No, this is true because I had this representation. And as I emphasized before, when you have another polynomial, it's not true that you can replace the lambda I squared by V of lambda I. That's false. So you cannot use this.
Does it mean essentially I can get here when I just simply before you put something?
No.
No, because I would have no, okay, I can look at Feinberg and Z and guess on, you know, but that's not the way it was. Okay, so now, one thing does work well if we look at that distribution,
which is the law of the singular value. Now, if you know that the eigenvalues of Bischoff matrices have a joint distribution of eigenvalues, so the singular values of X have an expression for the joint distribution. If we take V of X, X star, that's just a change of measure that depends on the singular value. So, of course, we also have a joint distribution for the singular values of this matrix. And that joint distribution is the one I wrote here. So if you write the singular values of X, you get this joint distribution, what I wrote here. Okay? Now, this is of the same form as the story I told you before with all this large deviation principle. We have an expression. Everything here can be written as a functional of the empirical measure. So it's e to the n squared functional of the empirical measure. So we can play the same game. And when you do play the same game, you now get something over measures on the real line, because now all eigenvalues are real. We are talking about singular values, so singular values are real. And that's the rate function. That's the I that we need to minimize. Okay? And this is a classical problem in weighted potential theory. The logarithmic potential is probably the most studied in that field. So everything is known. In particular, if V is a polynomial, we know how the solution will look. Typically, it will be a solution, the density will be a solution of an algebraic equation. And what is important is that if V looks like this, then the minimizer might have a support that is essentially here. So this is not that surprising if you think of it physically, right? You have a logarithmic potential, you have a logarithmic interaction, you have a potential V that has valleys. So of course, you want to be at the bottom of the valleys. Now there is a little bit of repulsion because of the log, so you don't want to put everybody too close together. But if the wells are deep enough, then, of course, the measure will be concentrated in the bottom. And this can be proved for appropriate Vs. Yes?
So, with the intuitive picture, so if there are interactions, we're thinking in terms of interactions, but then we also have these wells.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these wells are supposed to come from an interaction. So.
No, this well comes from the V. The interaction is provided by the two-point correlation, two-point potential, which is a log. So V is a potential per particle. There is no interaction there. Each particle sees a field V. It's some kind of external force.
And the particles interact with each other.
Right.
Log.
Right. It's a Coulomb. It's a Coulomb type interaction, except that it's on the line. And that's what. Okay.
So actually, since the solution is given by an algebraic equation, you know where the support will be. It's related to cuts in the solutions, and everything is known for such problems. In particular, it's easy to create examples where the minimizer will be supported on several intervals. And if I have a high degree of V, I can create as many intervals as I want. So if those are the singular values, what I would think for the eigenvalues is that the eigenvalues will be distributed in several rings, each one corresponding to a band of singular values. And the theorem of Feinberg and Z is that this is not. Okay? There is a single ring. That's why I found the theorem a priori intriguing. I can easily create an example where the singular values are supported on several intervals, but not the eigenvalues. Okay, so that I wanted to tell you. Yes?
Because there is a uniform distribution along the disk.
No, it's not uniform.
But then
In principle, you can have two disks, right?
No, I'm not cheating. When I say that the support is that, I mean that the support is that. So it's not zero. I don't take a region where the density is zero and I call it part of the support. Otherwise, support has a well-defined meaning, right? It's a closed set, it's the smallest closed set that the whole distribution is supporting.
Okay. Now, of course, as I said,
I really cannot make a rigorous sense of the proof. And usually is the case, if you see a hard problem and you can't solve it, you generalize it. So here is a generalization. So take X to be UDV, where U and V are hard distributed, independent, and D is some diagonal matrix. You will recognize here just the composition of X. And our law that I have erased, maybe it's hidden here. No, not hidden here, so I've erased it. Anyway, the law is unitary invariant because of the way that I define it. So under their model, X is of the form UDV. And what we are asking, and the empirical measure of the entries of D is exactly the empirical measure of the singular values. So we know its limit. So our situation is we have a diagonal matrix D, and we conjugate it right and left, not conjugate, we multiply it right and left by independent halves. That's in contrast with the Hermitian case where we conjugate it with one unit half. So here we multiply right and left with two different halves, and we're asking about the empirical measure. I give you the empirical measure of D, or I give you the limit of the empirical measure of D, that is supported on 25 intervals. And I'm asking what is the empirical measure of the eigenvalues of that matrix. Okay? And the question, what can we say? And of course, in these situations, there is no explicit expression for the joint distribution of eigenvalues. You cannot integrate out the rotation to get a joint law on singular values. The situations where you can integrate out the rotation is a good situation, because you can do all the large deviation tricks that I told you about. So that's our problem. So now, this, lucky for me, the Stiglitz transform was introduced in the last talk, so in the last several talks, actually. So here is a Stiglitz transform of D. So that's the empirical Stiglitz transform. It's just a normalized trace of Z minus D to the minus 1. D is diagonal, remember. So that's what is written here. And I need also another object that I will call sigma nz, which is a minimal singular value of the matrix zi minus x. So x is our random matrix. Zi minus x for z complex is a well-defined matrix. And you can look at the minimal singular. And here is a theorem of its joint work with Alice Guionnet and Manju Krishnapur. Some technical assumptions, blah, blah. Then, conclusion, mu and x converges to a limit which is of the form I told you, singular. Okay? So, that's part A of the theorem, technical assumptions, conclusion. Part B, technical assumptions are satisfied by the fine divisibility model. Okay? So, the technical assumptions, I should say something about the technical assumptions. They come on two types. One type, which is easy, is something that has to do with a singular value. Now, the singular values, because we know the joint distribution of the singular values, that has been studied to death. You can look it up in any degree of precision. Riemann-Hilbert method apply. You have as much information as you wish, in particular, the very mild information we ask here, which is that the Stiglitz transform does not blow up when we get close to the real line, is known. So that's one thing. This is trickier, because what is sigma nz? Sigma nz is a certain minimal singular value of some random matrix distributed according to my awful distribution. And I'm asking something about, essentially, what is a minimal singular value of such matrix? What can we say about the small singular values? Yes.
So the condition on the coherent form, is it necessary? So
necessary for us.
It's not. If that condition is violated, you don't have non-convergence.
No, but we don't have a proof.
Okay.
Yes. So, I should emphasize it. I don't believe that these conditions are in any way sharp. They are just what we need to make the machine.
So the minimal singular value is a question about an object that we don't control very well. And I'll come back to that later. But as I said, part of the theorem is that they are satisfied in finite density. Okay. Maybe this I can go quickly. So I wanted to give you the result. Now I can go back and tell you something about methods. So for Hermitian matrices, I guess everybody in this room, or almost everybody, knows that there is a semicircle law with a limit given by Wigner. Now, there are many methods of proof, but I want to emphasize those that bypass the explicit joint density. So suppose you have IID entries, not Gaussian. In the Gaussian case, I gave you a proof. Just use a look at the large deviation principle associated with the joint distribution. Take the minimizer of the rate function, those will be the same. But suppose you have independent entries. Well, one method is a method of moments. That's a very robust method. It's a bit painful because you have to do combinatorics, but we are adults, we can do it. So you do it, you find the Catalan numbers, it's actually a nice enumeration, and you get the semicircle. Another method that I want to emphasize for the purpose of the talk is the method that was, as far as I know, in this context introduced by Marchenko-Pastour, which is the Stilgis transform, the Cauchy transform. So what you do, you write, so you define the Stilgis transform of the empirical measure. Now, convergence of Stilgis transforms in a region of the complex plane up, somewhere up near infinity, is equivalent to weak convergence. So if you want weak convergence, it's enough to know convergence of Stilgis transforms. And now, what you try to do is you say, well, this can be written as a certain trace of your random matrix. So what you do is a perturbation. What is a perturbation? The perturbation is you erase a row and column in your matrix. And you write what some people call the resolvent identity and some other people call the matrix inversion lemma. So you relate the Stilgis transform of the original object to the Stilgis transform of the perturbed object, the one in which you erased one row and one column. When you do that, you get an equation. I skip the details, but you get an equation. And the error term here, you use some probabilistic estimates to show that it is small. So by probabilistic estimates, I mean either concentration of measure, if you like concentration of measure, or variance computation, if you don't like concentration. Here, variance computation is good enough. So you do one of these two, and you get this type of equation. Now, of course, in the limit, you say, well, this will disappear. The solution of this quadratic equation you can write down explicitly, and lo and behold, what you find is a Stilgis transform of the semicircle. So then all you have to show is that the solution is robust. Namely, if I put here a small error on the right side, the solution of this quadratic equation is close to the solution when you have the error. And that's obvious because the solution is okay? So that's the method of Pastour and Marchenko. And that's unfortunate that I use here S transform because I'm lazy. This should be still. It has nothing to do with the S transform we saw. Okay. So now, this was taken to the circular law. So I told you that in the case that V is X, So the case that we have Gaussian matrix, non-Hermitian Gaussian matrices, Ginibri tells us that the limit is a uniform law on the disk. But you can ask the question, okay, that was for Gaussian entries. What happens if I don't put Gaussian entries? I just put IID entries. And this is what is called the circular law. And the theorem is the following. When the entries are IID, zero mean, identity variance, then the empirical measure of eigenvalues converges to the same law. So this may sound to you like the same step going from GUE to Wigner matrices. But remember, when you do GUE to Wigner matrices, you have the method of moments and you have still this transform. All that disappears completely when you deal with non-normal matrices. And the reason, maybe for those of you who never thought about such questions, I should explain where is the difficulty. What did I do with the eraser? Up there. Yes. So the big difficulty in why moments don't tell you much is the following matrix. Think of this matrix. Think of this important matrix. Okay. All eigenvalues of this matrix are zero. However, if I put here an epsilon, as n goes to infinity, all the eigenvalues are pushed to the unit circle. Okay? So this is very unstable. The eigenvalues, as opposed for Hermitian matrices, we have inequalities that tell us that if you perturb a little bit the entries, you control well the distance between eigenvalues in terms of the perturbation. This is not true for eigenvalues, and this is the example. You perturb a little bit here, one entry, which is rank one in one location by epsilon, you push the whole spectrum away. So we don't have stability, and that is the source of all difficulty. So that's a circular law. It appeared in the literature, so the history is interesting. So again, for those of you who have not seen it, this has been an active area in the last 4 or 5 years with spectacular advance. So this theorem is written in a paper by Girko in 84, okay, with a proof. But the proof is incomplete. And for many years, that was an open problem in general. And Bai, in 97, is the first to provide a proof where he assumed that the entries have density. And the form of the theorem, as I stated here, has been only very recently proved. There are two works, more or less simultaneous, using very similar tools by Gotze and Tichomirov, Tau and Vu. I should mention in this context also Rudelson and Vershinin. I'll say something about it. Now, I said there's an incomplete proof in Girko. It's stated as a theorem and a proof. So you read the proof, and you see there are beautiful ideas. And in particular, this hermitization trick enters there, and I'll explain it in just a second. And all the development later is based on Girko's approach, so I don't want to belittle. But there is a technical obstacle that I want to emphasize. And the technical obstacle, as you might have guessed looking at the conditions of the theorem, has to do with small singular values. And all this recent work goes back to the study of minimal singular values of certain random matrices. And the point is that all techniques that exist to study the minimal singular value are based on independence. So they are working very well for matrices with independent entries, which our matrices are not, except in the Gaussian. Okay, so what is the method of hermitization? The method of hermitization is a very nice idea, which is the following. Take a polynomial, which is Z minus lambda J. And now, write what I wrote there. Use the fact that the Laplacian of the Laplacian of the log is a Dirac, and integrate by parts, to get the equality that I wrote up there. So if phi is a nice smooth test function, the integral of Laplacian phi times log p, log of the modulus of p, is equal to the sum of phi of lambda j. Okay? That's just the heat equation in two dimensions. Now, apply this to the characteristic polynomial of a matrix, right? P is just a polynomial, so apply that to the characteristic polynomial. What do you get? You get that psi of z dln is just dln. This just means that we are looking at the sum. What is written here? 1 over n sum of psi of lambda I. So that's the right side of that equality. So write it, write, use the equality. Now, what is a characteristic polynomial? It's the determinant of this matrix. So when you apply the previous identity, you get this equality. Now, this is almost done, except that I don't like modulus. So instead of taking, since this is a determinant, the absolute value of the determinant, I can write it as a determinant of the product of the matrix and its transpose. Oops, I started with something about eigenvalues. I ended with Hermitian matrices. We like Hermitian matrices. But eigenvalues are stable, etc. Except we have a family of Hermitian matrices. They are parameterized by Z. And so the conclusion is we need to understand, if we understand this Hermitian matrix well enough, we have a chance of understanding that. Now, one little problem that I want to emphasize. What is log det of that? Well, this is simply the sum of the log of, let's call it, sigma iz. So sigma iz are just the eigenvalues of this matrix. Right? The det is the product of eigenvalues, so it's the sum of the log of. Now, suppose I could prove that the empirical, this I can rewrite as an integral of log x b ln z, which is the empirical measure of this guy, maybe times n. Suppose I can prove that this converges. Problem is, I'm integrating a function that is singular at zero. Now, this is weak convergence. Everything I told you was about weak convergence. It's convergence against bounded continuous functions. Log at zero is not bounded continuous. It's singular, unless you say, well, that's a technical point. Remember that this formula is exactly tied to that singularity. So the fact that this formula is true is related to the fact that the log is singular at zero. So we cannot, in a too cavalier form, just balance that away, which is essentially what Gierko did. So essentially, Gierko was here, and he said, well, ln converges, this converges, and so forth. Not in these words, but he had an extra step of going through a Fourier transform, which masked this problem. But that's the what was happening. Okay, so the problem is the singularity of the log. Now, how did Bai solve it? I know I'm running out of time, but that's good, because then we will not see the awful things that I prefer for you. So what Bai said in the case of the circular law is very similar to the idea that I told you of peeling off rows and columns. He said, well, I need to understand the minimal singular value of a certain matrix with independent entries. So I'll think of this matrix as a perturbation of a slightly smaller matrix to which I added some columns. And this operation of adding the columns is independent of the matrix. So condition on the smaller matrix, I'm just adding some columns. But it's like adding a random variable to something. What happens when you add a random variable? You smooth. So he used this independence plus adding this extra random variable to smooth out the singularity of the log. And the huge progress of this gentleman, Rudelson, Vershinin, etc., was to say, well, we don't need density. Forget about density. We don't care about density. We're still using independence. And the fact that random projections cannot be too much aligned to a specific hypothesis. the specific direction. That's underlying their ideas, and then there are some arithmetic issues that pop in, etc., because they are not dealing with density. But all that is using independence. Both things, both the use of density and the use of these projections, conditions on a smaller subspace and adds a row and column. You can think of it this way. Okay. So, 1 minute. Yes. So, so 1 minute, then I can do the following. Now comes someone said about guessing the limit. So, yes. So, now what you say, okay, let's see what happens when n goes to infinity. Let's try to understand what is going on. And when n goes to infinity, there's a theorem of Hagerup and Larsen which says the following. If you take a free product, u and t, where u and t, u is unitary, t is positive, and you look at ut, then you get the same theorem as I claimed. Wow, that's wonderful, because that's our situation. We have u dv, forget that one u is not important, so we are really in this situation, so that should explain everything. That was at the level of the limit. So what can we say? Well, we can bring ourselves, if we look at this matrix, you can do some algebra, and bring yourself to a situation where you are studying a matrix as written up there. W is some Haar matrix, D is some diagonal matrix. And when you have a product of matrix times its transform, you can move to this representation to linearize everything. So if you want the eigenvalues of A star, you can look at the eigenvalues of this matrix and square them. So now we are looking at eigenvalues of a block matrix of this form, and A is of this form, u plus b. So what you do, you use some non-commutative calculus. Essentially, you say the following. I know, unfortunately. So what you do is you have a polynomial, you think of that as a polynomial in u, u star, and t. And what you say is, since we are invariant, since the law of u is Haar, or invariant under rotation, we can add a small rotation, this should have the same law. So the trace should be the same. So this means that the epsilon term should vanish. Okay? So the derivative, if you want, should vanish if we are invariant. Okay? The derivative is a certain object which can be written more compactly like that. You introduce a certain non-commutative derivative and you have this equation, which, at least in some parts of physics, are called Schwinger-Dyson equation, even if it doesn't look like. So this gives you an equation, at least at the level of the limit. And when you do this block version, there's an analog of that for one matrix. You have this analog for a block. This gives you an equation. Now what will happen in our situation? And this equation characterizes the limit. Now, what happens in our situation? We will have an equation like that with an error. We will control the error by concentration inequalities, which have been derived for the unitary groups. They work very well. And from that information, we are going to get the equation at least near infinity. And then the fun begins. We have to push everything down in order to control the integrability of the log. So we have to get close to the real line. I have no time to describe it, but I'd be happy to describe it to anybody interested. Thank you.
So, are there some similarities with this tool by Hagerup for calculating bound measure of, you probably know that work, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so.
This is, I mean, it's also the perturbation argument.
Yes, so, in a sense, we branch into his proof to identify the limits. We show that we have the same equation. The techniques are different, though, because we need to control all these errors along the way. Whereas he worked already as a level of the limits, so he didn't have to worry about that. I should add, and this is related to that, that recently we have strengthened it. We can now prove that not only you have weak convergence of the empirical measure, but the support convergence.
Oh, yeah.
And again, that's not quite the same thing as dealing with self-adjoint. A lot of difficulties are coming, but that's part of the result, right? Those slides are slightly older, so it's not, it doesn't appear, but that is also.
So I wonder if dealing with matrices, you estimate at some point the size of the pseudoscape.
I'm not sure what you mean by pseudoscape. So then probably this will be discussed.
So let's think of again.